Coming up on this week's edition of A Swing and a Bell, it's Father's Day, so we'll talk about and to some dads and their lives in baseball. You'll hear from Randall Grichuk, the outfielder for the Toronto Blue Jays, and the impact that his dad has had on his baseball career, both in a pure dad sense, but also as his coach, as he coached Randall for a number of years from Little League up through some of his teenage years. Ben will turn the microphone around on me. We do a Voices of the Game segment every week, and Ben said to me, you know, Dad, you're kind of a baseball broadcaster yourself. Why don't I interview you about your career? Kids get what they want, so gave the mic to Ben, and away we went. But first,
it's up to you, it's only love. It's hard to tell what I'm thinking of. Down the street takes me to you. There we'll meet, you know it's true.
The Sheepdogs, a terrific classic rock band from Saskatchewan and huge, huge sports fans. Ben and I had a chance recently in Toronto to sit down in studio with the lead singer of the Sheepdogs, Ewan Curry, and his dad, Neil, who is, if possible, an even bigger sports fan than Ewan is. And we had a great chat about sports and music, of course, with Ewan being in music. And Neil, his dad, has his DMA, Doctor of Musical Arts and Composition. His career has ranged from a classical composer to a university professor to a choir director at St. Paul's Cathedral. But first and foremost, it feels to me, he's a big, big sports fan, as is his son Ewan. So Ben and I had a chance to have a great chat with them about everything in the world of sports and music that came to our minds. Well, Father's Day is coming up, and this is fun on a couple of levels as we do this episode of the podcast. Very happy to have Ewan Curry of the Sheepdogs and his dad, Neil. They're in from Saskatchewan, and I got my son, Ben, who people who have listened to the podcast are familiar with. And as I just said to you guys, we've got no agenda. It can be fathers and sons, basketball, hockey, football. Well, not hockey, basketball, football, baseball. I know hockey's not is not up at the top of the list. Whatever's on your minds, we can do. Firstly, welcome to Toronto. Very happy to have you with us, and a big Blue Jays fan, from what I understand.
Yeah, that's we follow football and basketball pretty closely, but the one team above all else that we really kind of pay attention to on a day-to-day level is definitely the Jays.
Are you, and I'll try to identify people since we've got four voices going here, so this is you and talking right now, old enough to remember 92 and 93 vividly?
Not exactly, because we moved to, I was actually born in Australia and I came to Canada in 1995, so when we got here it was sort of the, I think at that time, 93, 92, like our relatives in Canada were sending us like World Series hats and things like that.
We weren't getting the games in Australia at that time.
Nothing.
I think we got some delayed broadcasts of some of the World Series, but the majority of it we did not get.
Cricket and Aussie rules.
You know? Okay, so let's go back with Dad, because you're from Moose Jaw, so you're Canadian. So going back even further, a Blue Jays fan back in the day?
Well, initially I was an Expos fan, but eventually, you know, nationalism kicked in and I want to see the team do well. But it was especially fired up by those great, you know, teams of the late 80s and early 90s.
Oh, we welcome fans from all teams here. This is a non-judgmental environment here. So, so 95, you come to Canada, and coincidentally, that's the first year I started doing baseball games. So we were just talking about that a little bit. But living in Saskatchewan and rooting for a team a couple thousand miles away, is it just that they were in Canada? What drew you to them right away?
Well, that's what's on TV. I mean, you got, you know, you fire up the TV and there, you know, it's you and Buck calling the games. And, you know, and then it's just like there's a, you know, maple leaf on the jersey, so you got to root for the team. But also Saskatoon is super far away from major American cities, so it's like there's not like a real close big city in the U.S. that you can root for anyway.
Right.
So it feels isolated.
Yeah, so I was wondering, growing up in Saskatoon, obviously it's pretty far away from Toronto. Are you able to get every game on TV? Are you getting all the news about the team, or is there a bit of a disconnect because of the distance from the Blue Jays?
No, I think even back then it was, you know, we had every game if you had whatever cable, you know, so you could watch them. And I don't think it was like on the tip of everyone's tongue the way like hockey is out there, and certainly the Rough Riders as well, but you know, ball fans.
To be honest, our long history of Strat-O-Matic baseball really prepared us for the majors.
Right.
The boys learned that as kids, as I had before. And so our understanding of the workings of baseball were perhaps, at least on paper and using dice, a little more intensive than your average fan.
So he's smiling because I didn't do it with him. My dad did that with me.
Yeah.
I grew up on Strat-O-Matic.
back in the 70s, probably 78, 79, 80 is when I played. And I would play this whole season. The school I went to was far away from where I lived. I couldn't find anybody to play. So I'd force my dad, I'd even force my poor sister sometimes to sit down and play Strat-O-Matic with me. And, well, so this will probably mean something. Like, you can remember if a guy's home run, it was he like a 1-5 guy or a 1-7 guy or a 1-8. You know what all that means,
yes,
right?
Oh,
so,
yeah,
and I haven't seen those cards in 30 or 35 years, but I can tell you what certain guys, what Otto Velez's card looked like from 1978.
Well, yeah, we got the same thing. I think his first season he had was like 1968.
The year of the pitcher.
Yeah, which is the famous Bob Gibson year,
right,
and everything. And I think we can remember, like, Tony Oliva has, like, a little, like, purple mark on the card. Like a.
That's because we spilled grape freshie on him in 1969.
So now that game still exists, but I don't know if people are playing it with dice and cards. I think it's all online, I would assume, now. Do you
more computerized,
yeah,
except for the old dinosaurs like me.
Well, that's hardcore. Okay, that's a lot of respect there, playing Strat-O-Matic back in the day. You played some football, though, back in university, right?
I did, yeah.
At the University of Saskatchewan.
Yeah, 2002 to 2005.
Defensive lineman.
Yes.
Okay.
I was a little bit bigger, but it was tough because I was like 17 to 19 when I played. And at that time, like, there was a bunch of junior football out west. I don't think it was as much in Ontario. But there were guys playing that were like 25 and 26 at that time. And, like, when you're 17 and you're trying to go up against a 25-year-old man, it's pretty tough.
Right.
Well, an over 300-pound lineman.
Yeah.
Ewan came out of high school. He was 235, and I was saying, oh, my baby's going to have to play against these Giants, you know. He did fine, though.
What was your sport growing up to play?
It was baseball. Yeah. I played most of my senior baseball, actually, in Australia, where it's very active. It's not like here where you have to play, you know, slow pitch or something like that if you're below a professional level. It was a good, hard game, and the Aussies play hard, so we had the full regalia, umpires and everything.
Yeah.
And so... And they could play all year round because of the weather.
Give me a scouting report on you. What position, which way did you hit, what were your strengths?
Well, I played mostly second base and the outfield because I ran pretty well. Didn't have a great arm. As the years went on, I became a better hitter for average, and I was able to hit with some power. So, but they would often stick me either at the top or the bottom of the lineup because I ran better than most of the Aussies,
right,
for some reason.
So one of the greatest joys I've had as a dad is coaching this guy in baseball. He played rep baseball for eight or nine years, first baseman for the Thornhill Reds. Like his dad, left-handed and slow, so it was predetermined what position we were going to play. But just, you know, doing the driving trips to Chatham or Leamington or Sarnia for tournaments, talking baseball all the way, whether it was whatever sport it was, do you guys have a lot of, I mean, were there road trips for sports that you were playing in or Seamus was playing in or whatever the case
was? To an extent, within Saskatchewan.
Right.
Yeah. It's actually ironic because, I mean, I remember back to my actual baseball trips when I was younger. It was like right in the back seat of the car with the Walkman on listening to music. So it was like I was doing baseball but studying music. And now I'm a professional musician and I drive around all these places and I listen to the Blue Jays games on the radio. So it's completely flipped.
Do you like going to all kinds of ballparks? Have you visited a bunch of ballparks in the U.S.?
Yeah, I went to quite a few. I spent a lot of time in San Francisco, so I went to, that ballpark over and over, and Oakland as well, especially when the Jays go down. And, you know, I think went to Philly and Pittsburgh and Anaheim and Dodger Stadium,
right,
those kind of places.
You're doing all right. It's another thing we do. We're trying to get them to all 30 ballparks.
Oh, yeah.
And we do two or three a year. As it used to be as my schedule allows. Now it's as his schedule allows, of course.
Yeah.
We made it to Yankee Stadium this year, so we're at 25. So
wow.
Give you and give him two or three. Give him his bucket list places he's got to go to.
Fenway's great. If you haven't been there, that might be my favorite park in baseball. Yankee was awesome. Going to Minnesota was actually really fun.
Minnesota's a very cool park.
I liked it a lot.
It's probably the closest park to Saskatchewan, I would think. But yeah,
they're about the same.
Yeah.
Technically, Seattle is closer.
Okay.
Actually, we did Seattle. It was a nice ballpark, too, and there's always a lot of Canadians there, too.
A lot. Yeah, a lot. Wrigley, awesome.
Yeah.
You haven't been to Wrigley or Fenway?
I was hanging out with a guy that actually was throwing out the first pitch, so I got to like hang on the field for a little bit at the start of the game, and so it was pretty wild.
Cool. Have you thrown out a first pitch at the Rogers Center?
I have, yeah.
How did that go?
It went okay. It was at a time in my life I hadn't played baseball in a few years. So I hadn't thrown a ball, and we like had a bunch of shows leading up to it. So they hand you the ball, and I just kind of like puffed it in there. And it wasn't a great pitch, but it was by no means a disaster.
Well, I'll tell you what you both have. You guys are huge fans of Pat and Buck. So before the game, you guys decided to kind of sport something. So why don't you turn around, have a look here. Guys, we don't see too many of these around anymore, but we got Tabler and we got Martinez jerseys. The Sheepdogs are your number one fans.
Well, we appreciate that, fellas. Thanks a lot. And That was a nice first pitch tonight we saw, too. But that's great. And congratulations on your career playing here. And it was a packed house outside before the game.
They threw a strike, too, right? Threw a strike right there. Just like you would have thrown a strike. He was your guy. It's my second favorite band now. My second favorite band. Anybody who's going to...
I actually think I was there. Really? I don't remember the pitch, but I do think I was there, if I'm going to be honest.
Was it all right? Didn't bounce?
If it's not memorable, it must have gone at least okay.
That's exactly what I was going for.
The ones you don't remember about it.
Shooting for the corner.
My bro Seamus threw a good pitch, too, and Ryan, our bass player, another time threw it, and he actually fired a pretty good strike. So, nice. But he warmed up a bunch.
Nice. What connections have you had? Well, my son, Ben will tell you, he saw you at Massey Hall, as we discussed before we came on. You've played outside the Rogers Center, right? There was a time, was it 2015?
A couple times. With Sheepdogs, and Seamus and I have a band called Bros that we also played out there. It's a nine-man band, and so they always give you a whatever custom Jays jersey you want to wear when you do those shows. So we had Bros number 1 through 9, and we actually got pants and hat and big socks and did the full Jays uniform. Because we had a nine-man band, so we figured we might as well make it a baseball team.
Makes sense. If you were the general manager of the Blue Jays right now,
oh boy,
what moves are you making in the next couple of months?
I never know what to say with these things because, I mean, you hope that the people in charge are smarter than you when it comes to baseball operations, but maybe I'll defer to the old man here. Dad?
Wow, he played hot potato pretty good right
there. Yeah. They got a lot of these new guys like Solarte and Diaz, and they've done pretty well. You know, I think Teoscar is able to hit well, but they don't seem to have a lot of complete players. I feel that it really is kind of time for a big change.
You want speed and fielding, right?
I'm in favor of speed, fielding, and on-base myself, so I'm kind of a dinosaur. I'm not a big fan of home runs, which are very important to the Jays. I also worry about the ability of the field manager to be able to still stimulate his players while wanting to remain diplomatic in my comments on
that. You're doing a nice job.
But I really feel that they really lack rounded players, all-round players.
Okay. Can I jump into music for a second?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, so one thing I'm going to defer to Ben because he was at your concert and he knows more about your music than I do. But on the cover of Rolling Stone, tell me how that happened and how cool a moment that was for you guys when that happened.
Sure. Well, in 2011, we were a pretty, we were sort of a hard grinding, unsuccessful rock band. And then we got kind of wrapped up in this competition where they had a whole bunch of unsigned bands that people in the music industry submitted to this competition, and somehow we ended up in the 16. And it was kind of like, a March Madness type of thing where they whittled it down to 8 and 4 and finally 2 and then declared a winner.
And was it just readers voting or
readers
online?
Readers voting online. Yeah. It was sort of like a whole Rolling Stone push to like draw a lot of online things. It was their attempt to kind of modernize. And so they were making this push, and the prize was you got to be in the cover, and you got a record deal with Atlantic Records, which is the home of Aretha. And
the voting was thrown open to the general public.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we had to do various little competition-y things, which is always weird because, like, when you get into music, it's not supposed to be a competition. It's supposed to be an artistic pursuit, and competition is for sports. But it was a tremendous opportunity for us, and it gave us a lot of press.
You vote once or twice, Dad?
It could be said, yeah.
Yes.
I thought it was a fantasy until I actually heard some of the songs they released after about the second round. And I listened to them one night and I thought, as a professional musician myself, I honestly think they have the ability to win this. And I just had the strangest feeling. And then they went on and did.
Tell us about your experience at Massey Hall and some of the songs of theirs that you like the best.
I had a great experience. It was... I would say definitely the best concert that I haven't been to a ton of concerts, but it was definitely my favorite concert, not just because you're sitting in the room with me right now.
Appreciate it.
I don't know. I like some of the older stuff. Like Southern Dreaming is probably my favorite song that you guys played. It was really awesome. But I just thought the whole atmosphere was great. Like the music was obviously great and the lighting was cool and being at Massey Hall and it's about to get renovated. So it's like the last time that it's really going to be like that. It kind of just felt like we were back in the past a little bit. I don't know, because you guys have a very individual, different sound, something that we don't always see today. So yeah, it was an awesome concert for sure.
It was a very special one for us. That's not a lot of really special venues in Canada. Like we've been lucky to go to the States a fair amount and over to Europe. And obviously there's a lot more older sort of famous places over there. But in Canada, Massey Hall is you know, clearly the most famous one. So it was really special.
Influence, musical influences growing up? Anybody, not that you pattern yourself after, but that you,
oh,
you
yeah.
really thought
well,
so.
Well, definitely. I mean, we, you know, the old man would play Stevie Wonder and Creedence and that kind of stuff. And even, you know, Frank Sinatra. And so a pretty diverse list of stuff. And then I really just, you know, when I was a young man, I was really into, like, you know, Sloan, who are, you know, a Canadian rock band. And then just Beatles and Led Zeppelin. And really just as soon as I got into sort of the classic era, like, I always talk about this, like, I was sort of 15, 16 at the time that, like, Napster and you know, the internet just opened up, mm-hmm. like, every musical possibility for me. And I just went wild, like, just finding everything I could. And it really, like, for a young, hungry musical mind, like, I just feasted on all this available music. And it sort of just meant that I could go right to what I wanted to hear and not have to rely on, like, you know, somebody in the neighborhood handing me a record or something
right.
like that.
There's one song of yours that we were listening to, and I said, it feels like there's a little Burton Cummings in there somewhere. I don't know if that's real or I'm imagining that at all. Or
well, that would be the style that Ewan's voice would belong to. He just naturally tends towards the kind of sound that Burton has, and that's a blessing.
He's one of the greats. Actually, just did a little thing. He's getting, like, some Hall of Fame songwriter honor here in Canada, and I think it's in a couple of weeks, but we just did a little video for him.
Nice.
Big fan.
Nice. Yeah. The tour, you're going across the pond and coming
yeah.
back.
Yeah, we got Spain, UK, some festivals here, and then back down to the States, and we're doing kind of shows all the way through the rest of the year.
What's more fun, being in the studio, making music, or being on tour, playing music?
Very tough. I love both, and unfortunately, it just seems like, you know, you'd love to do sort of like a week of one and a week of the other, or back and forth, but it's kind of like you do a whole bunch of one, and then you do a whole bunch of the other, so... I can't answer either. It's just they're both great.
All right, let me ask Dad. Bucket list sporting event. What's the one thing you haven't been to that you want to go to?
I've actually never been to an NFL game, so I would really like to do that.
What's your team?
Well, Seattle.
Okay.
So I'm a bit in mourning at the moment, but they had such a wonderful team. But
yeah.
Thank God they still got Russell Wilson. But I'm a good. I'm able to go to secondary teams. Like, it's not just one or none. I could practically go down the whole league and put them in rank order as to who I would cheer for. So.
In the NFL?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've gotten emails from him where he's done that. He's ranked for
all 32 teams? Yeah. We're huge Green Bay fans. Where do the Packers? Packers are probably near the bottom if you're a Seattle fan, I would guess. How do you feel about the Packers?
They've had some nasty matchups over the last few years.
That wild playoff game three or four years ago.
Like, it was 15-0 until almost no time left.
Wasn't it the Seattle game when the refs were out on strike when we got screwed in the...
There's one where Golden Tate makes a catch that isn't a touchdown by rule, but that's what they called it.
That's 2012. That's what Seattle was just
And then there's Clinton Dix doesn't intercept a ball that was in the air for like 10 seconds, and it lands in, and then it goes to overtime, and in one play, Russell Wilson burns us down the whole field.
That was the cross field throw.
I can remember where it was at all these games. Was it the first one I was in? Like a hotel room in like Fredericton watching on a Monday night. And then the other game, I was in Memphis watching that game at a buddy's house.
Having said that, I'm a huge fan of Aaron Rodgers. I think he's
We love him. Yeah, we love him.
He's
now,
special.
Now, we're fans, but we wouldn't trade him for Brady or anybody else. But,
but I'm also a fan of Brady. Yeah. I mean, it's hard not to be. I've cheered against him my whole life, but he's tremendous. Right. He really is.
You and bucket list event for you. Anywhere in the world, any sport?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I've pretty lucky to have seen a fair bit of basketball, football, and major league stadiums, but I'm not sure. I love the idea of like hitting every ball stadium. There's some parks that I really want to go to just for the sort of the vibe, you know, like Milwaukee. I've been kind of eyeing up.
Milwaukee's cool.
I love like the sort of blue collar, like beer drinking kind of towns where there's, you know, taverns on the corner and the vicinity of the ballpark. And
Milwaukee's your town.
Yeah, Milwaukee's a good place.
They do beer very well in Milwaukee.
That's my jam right there.
A World Series Game 7 at a classic park like Fenway or Wrigley, that would be super.
It is great. It is great. All right, well, so maybe the four of us will we'll bucket list together.
That's right.
And we'll figure it out. It's Father's Day weekend also. We really appreciate this. Have a great tour. Hope
Thank
it
you.
Goes well for you. And pleasure meeting you guys. Hope to see you again.
Very much.
Cheers.
Big, big thanks to Ewan Curry and Dad Neil for spending some time with us. If you want to know more about the Sheepdogs, they're touring the UK in late June, then Canada and the US from July through September, including a stop in Toronto at Echo Beach on September the 20th. You can find out more on their website at thesheepdogs.com. I feel the dawn.
down the baby. It looks nice, you don't have to tell me more than once or twice. I've kicked on the brakes and found my walking shoes. I find a way to rig it so that I can't lose.
Sportsnet returns as the exclusive home of everything Blue Jays. Get breaking news and reaction as it happens.
How about that?
From the clubhouse to the dugout and on the field. All access, all the time.
Bringing a drive deep to right.
A no-quit team off and on the field. Canada's deepest roster of baseball experts. Only on Sportsnet, the exclusive home of everything Blue Jays.
The pitch. A swing, and there's a drive. Deep left center field. Back to the wall. It's in the basket. It's in the basket, and a slam for Gretzik.
Happy birthday, Randall. Fastball sent into shallow right field. And Gretzik, did he catch that ball? It's being called a catch. And if that holds up, it's going to be an inning-ending double play. And obviously, Texas may want to have a look at this one, and I got to tell you, we want to have a look at it, too.
What an effort by Randall Gritchett.
One ball, one strike to count. And the pitch from Cashner. And a swing and a high fly ball. Well hit, deep left field. It's gone! Randall Gritchett stays hot.
Is he giving an interview sitting down?
It's a casual interview, yes.
Did you request this?
Yes, this is a casual interview. Wow. You a big time. Now I know that you're really a big time.
I'm with big time Randall Gritchick.
Well, like so many professional athletes, Randall Gritchick was heavily influenced by his dad. His dad spent a lot of time working with him as a kid, coaching him, in fact, and helping him become the ball player that he is. His dad's name is George. The family grew up in Texas. And recently, I had a chance to sit down with Randall this Father's Day week and find out about his relationship with his dad and the impact that had on his baseball career. Randall, I'm sure like a lot of guys who grow up to become professional athletes, your dads are heavily involved, and this being Father's Day week, tell me a little bit about your dad. Did he play? Give me a little background on him and how he impacted you in baseball.
So my dad played softball growing up. I got to watch him a little bit. He said in baseball, he played high school baseball, and he said he couldn't run, throw, hit, or catch. So that kind of ended his career. But he loved the game, and that's what got me involved in it, and you know, it's got me where I'm at today.
So when you're a little kid, 5'6", just starting out, T-ball, I mean, is he coaching you or is he working with you in the backyard? What kind of a role did he play?
Both. You know, we played in the backyard baseball. He coached me up until I was in high school. So every year it was actually him and a good friend of mine, their dads. One managed, one coached. The next year one would coach, one would manage. So everything I learned growing up was from him.
I know I coached my son for 7 years in travel ball, obviously not nearly at the same level that you eventually got to. And I was tougher on him probably than I was on the other kids because you can't show favoritism. So was your dad tougher on you than the other kids on the team?
A little bit. I think he was tougher on me just because he knew I had some talent and he knew that he knew I loved the game and he knew something could happen or come from it, even if that was just college ball. So he was tough on me in a good way, definitely.
What were the rules? Like, did the homework have to be done before he could play catch or go to the cage? Like, what were the rules in the Gritchick household?
Yeah, he definitely made me get my homework done. He was the enforcer when it came to doing homework. There were definitely some nights I didn't want to, and he laid the law down. But, yeah, it was definitely no watching TV, no playing ball, no doing nothing until you got your homework done. And then once that was done, I think it was probably made him more happy than me to be able to go work because he loved the game and he loved, you know, teaching me and just being around it with me.
What kind of lessons did he instill in you? Not so much the baseball stuff, but what sort of mindset did he try to give you as you were growing up and getting into more competitive baseball?
Just kind of play the game the right way. Be humbled. Don't showboat it when your things are going good. And just kind of be level-headed. There was a kind of little league. I was probably a little bit better than my competition at the time, and I kind of was a little cocky about it, and he definitely sat me down and told me to go about it the right way and told me don't act like that anymore. So he was very stern with me when it came about going the right way, and I'm thankful for that. You know, I like to try to think I play the game hard and play the game the right way and don't show people up, and that's definitely from him.
Was he the head coach, third base coach? Like, what kind of role did he have on the team?
He was the head coach. In Little League, it's kind of like every coach does everything. Right. So yeah. He kind of did hitting, did pitching, did everything, wrote the lineups out. I'd tell him I want to play somewhere or bat somewhere, and he would definitely not agree. And whatever he wanted is what I had to do. I didn't get much say-so in it. But, I was definitely blessed that he was so involved in my baseball career, you know, pre-high school level. And, you know, like I said, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here. He loved the game, and he definitely instilled that love in me.
Once you get to pro ball now, you get drafted, you have milestones on your way up through the minors, you get to the majors. Is he normally the first phone call when something happens?
Yeah. Actually, when I got called up for the first time in 2014, we were in Round Rock, Texas, playing AAA, and my family's from Houston, so they came down for it. So I actually got told and was able to go out to the parking lot and tell them, and his initial reaction was, stop joking. You're messing with me. But, yeah, anytime I do something good, I get a text or a call from him. You know, he watches every game, and if for some reason he can't watch it, he records it and then goes home and watches it. So I don't get a text for 3 or 4 hours later, then I know he had to go watch it later. He doesn't want to know what I did. He watches it later. So, it's just as special for him as it is for me.
Does he still coach you and give you tips, like if in a bat doesn't go well, or is he just pure dad right now?
No, he'll never be pure dad. If things aren't going well like they weren't earlier in the year, he's very go to the cage tomorrow early, watch the ball, do this, do that. A little more involved than I'd probably like at times. But, I know he loves me, and he knows that I got the talent, and he wants me to get the most out of it.
I appreciate you sharing this with us. Thanks very much for the time.
No problem.
Sportsnet has Canada's team covered.
How about that?
All access, all the time. Sportsnet, the exclusive home of everything Blue Jays.
Well, I can't keep looking backwards.
There's a lot for me to learn.
And I'm looking forward overly.
There's a lot for me to burn.
There's a world outside my window.
There's a lot for me to learn.
I hear less than half of what I see.
There's a lot for me to burn.
On this week's installment of Voices of the Game, something a little bit different. Ben came to me a few weeks ago and he said, you know, Dad, you're a voice of the game and you've got kind of an interesting story. He said, I should interview you for that segment 1 week on the podcast. So since Father's Day is upon us, we decided this would be a good week to do it. So, Ben, over to you.
No, I know a lot about your career. I don't know what year of broadcasting you're entering right now.
It's my 24th year of Major League Baseball, but my first job in Barrie, at CKBB in Barrie, when I started part-time on the weekends, was in 1990. So I guess you could say I've been at it over 28 years.
So your first job is in Barrie, but you start broadcasting in Western when you're at university.
That's true,
so,
yes.
I mean, I know a bit about that, but how did that exactly happen? How was it facilitated?
So first day of Frosh Week, I am looking for an extracurricular activity to do. You know, as my son, that I've always said to you, get involved. Do extracurriculars. Do something. Round out your resume. I've been that parent, and you know I got it from my parents, from your grandparents. So you can blame them if I was annoying to you as a dad. So I tried to do something at Western. I wanted to write for the Western Gazette, which was a great student newspaper. And I walked into the UCC, into the main building, and there were like 100 people in line. And I said, well, I'm not standing in this line on my first day of Frosh Week. So I started walking back toward my dorm and walked past a door that just said Radio Western. That's all it said on the door. And I walked in and I said, hey, is this the campus radio station? And some guy said, yeah. And I said, do you guys do sports? And they said, yeah. And I said, do you need volunteers? And they said, yeah. And that was Tuesday of Frosh Week. And that Saturday I was in Windsor working on a Western Windsor football game. They needed people. And I did color commentary. I don't remember if it was the first half or the second half. A buddy of mine did one of the halves, and I did the other half. And like a guy who had been there for a while did play-by-play. And I was the analyst for a football game like 5 days after I showed up at Western and had no idea what I was doing, but I was hooked. From the moment I started doing it, I was hooked.
So how long did it take you to get from an analyst to play-by-play? How long till they trusted you?
Not long. I started doing a lot of basketball, and I think basketball started a few weeks later, and I don't think they had as many people vying to do basketball. Football back then was, and I assume still is, the big sport at Western. You know, they've always had a good football program. So I started doing some basketball games, and I guess I didn't fumble it around too badly because they let me do more. And I remember the guy, Pod Armstrong, Kevin Armstrong, Pete Van de Boven Camp, Chris Cavender. These were all guys on the Western basketball team. I'm sure none of them had any idea that it was me doing the games. I was just some goofy-looking 18-year-old guy in first-year university. But I started doing a bunch of basketball games, did some football games, did a few hockey games, and then had a talk show that you probably know the name of called From the Cheap Seats that I did with a buddy of mine for 3 years, like a Friday afternoon talk show, and we would take calls and we would talk about sports issues and just kind of entertain ourselves.
So you move on from Western and you graduate, you become an actuary very briefly.
Very briefly.
And then you've made
just about as briefly as it took to have that conversation.
Yeah, and then you made the decision that you didn't want to be in actuarial science or in the actuary business.
Yeah.
How do you approach your parents, my grandparents about that? How does that go exactly that you're going to quit your job and go to did you have the job at Barry?
No. So I graduated, and my parents had very generously and wonderfully paid for my education, and I had worked hard. And actually, I had stopped doing stuff at the radio station in the fourth year of university to concentrate on passing the actuarial exams, which I did, and started working. And I'd say within a month or two, I felt, I don't know if this is for me. And, I was 22. I didn't have any money, so I'd moved back in with my parents after university, and I just said, if I'm going to try it, now's the time. If it doesn't go well, I'll figure it out. So I went to my parents, who, as are the best people on earth. You can't have better parents or grandparents. And I said to them, listen, I'm not happy and I want to try something else. I want to try radio. And I said, I'll make a deal with you. I said, you give me 2 years to see if I can make it. And I said, and also I'll write the GMAT, which is the entrance exam for business school. And I said, I'll write the GMAT, I'll get in somewhere, and if it doesn't work out in 2 years, I promise you I'll go to business school. And they said, okay. They weren't angry. They were nervous that I wasn't going to be able, they didn't know anybody in radio or TV or anything like that. And I had a good steady job at a university and was doing well and all that stuff. But they said, okay. And I got a job in Barrie shortly thereafter, and I wound up getting to Toronto about a year and a half later. So as soon as I got to Toronto and got to CJCL, the predecessor of The Fan, or Sportsnet Radio Network, as it's now known most commonly, they were happy. But I wouldn't say it was a tough sell, but they were not all in on it. Let's put it that way.
I want to talk a little about your time in Barrie. You weren't just a sportscaster when you were in Barrie. You were actually a full-time radio host, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask me this. Not a host, but a newscaster. Sportscaster, traffic, covered the courts, covered elections, did all kinds of things. And because it's a smaller town, and this is 28 years ago, too, so the world is a different place, you did things on radio then that you probably didn't do in bigger cities or don't do anymore. We did the Pet Patrol, which was if you lost a dog or I found a dog, CKBB was the place you called. And we would broadcast on the radio that Ben Shulman has lost his Chihuahua, and it looks like this, and its name is this, and its collar says this, and this is what we did. We did the Pet Patrol, and we also did the In Memoriam listings, which was, sadly, people pass away, and we would read the In Memoriam listings on the air, and we would tell people where the services were. Again, this is pre-internet in a smaller city, and the world was a much different place. And so all of a sudden, I'm like, I don't know anything about radio. I was just kind of doing some university football games and basketball games. And now I'm in a newsroom editing tape, covering elections, covering court cases, reading In Memoriam listings. And it's a good lesson for everybody. I was 23 years old. You do what you have to do in order to hopefully be able to do what you want to do further down the line.
You've gotten a chance to go a lot of cool places in your broadcasting career, and one of them being Norway.
Yes.
Where you went for the Olympics. You were pretty young when you went to Norway.
I was very young. This is pre-you. You weren't born. Your big brother, Matthew, was about 8 weeks old when I left and about 11 and a half weeks old when I came back. And the one thing I remember the most is he hadn't grown eyebrows yet at 8 weeks of age. He didn't have eyebrows when I left, and I came home and I said, holy cow, he's got eyebrows. He was like a different kid than I saw when I left. But it was hard leaving him, leaving your first child when they're such a baby and going to Norway. But yeah, I just through, an incredibly fortunate set of circumstances, I was given the opportunity to go to the Olympics in Lillehammer, which nobody but friends and family remembers. But I was the B guy for hockey. Don Chevrier was the A guy, and I did all the non-Canada games. So this is 1994. I'm 27 years old. I've done very, very little hockey play-by-play. I've done very little play-by-play of any kind other than what I did at Western. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm going over to Norway on a charter plane with CTV, wearing like a CTV crest on my blazer and covering hockey at the Olympics. It was the coolest thing. And it's the only Olympics I've ever done, and I'd love to have a chance to do another one. And it was just cool on 100 different levels. I'd never seen a reindeer before. That was cool. Norway wanted to make sure they were as environmentally friendly as they could be. So the arena where we did the games was dug out of the inside of a mountain. It was like driving the Batmobile into the Batcave, and all of a sudden there was an arena that sat 8,000 people inside this mountain. So it was really, really cool. And it was the Olympics where Peter Forsberg scored that great goal to beat Canada in the gold medal game. I think the last one before the pros game, if I'm not mistaken. And I didn't do that game. I was the reporter because Chevy was doing that game. But, you know, I got to see Paul Kariya, Peter Forsberg. Peter Nedved played for Canada in that game. And I remember, you know, he wouldn't know me if he was sitting in the room, but I remember a guy named Vyacheslav Bezukladnikov scored the first goal that I called. Russia played Norway in the first game. Quick, funny story. We want to go to the Russian practice the day before the first game because we want to just learn the players. Who's on what line, what numbers, what names and all that. But I guess they didn't quite, you know, trust us or anybody who wasn't part of their delegation. So they said, sure, you can come to practice. We go to practice the day before. There are like 50 players on the ice. None of them have jersey numbers on. So we're just watching 50 guys skate around. We have no idea who's who. The next day when they play Norway, they give us a roster about 10 minutes before the first game. And that's when we're trying to memorize everybody on the Russian team.
I want to go into a couple other kind of funny or crazy stories that have happened throughout your career. One of them involves, I believe it was a call from an ESPN executive. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that you didn't exactly believe or, did, yes. or were a little confused by who the caller
yes.
was.
So I'm working at the Fan, and I get a phone call in the newsroom. A gentleman says, hi, my name is Al Jaffe, and I work for ESPN, and I'd like you to come down and audition for ESPN Radio. And I thought it was my university roommate, Rob. And I said, ah, ha, ha, Rob, good one. You almost got me. You almost got me. And there's a pause on the phone, and then he says again, I'm going to say this one more time. My name is Al Jaffe. Da, 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 da. So it turned out to be a real ESPN executive asking me to come down and audition for ESPN Radio, which in 1993, I didn't even know existed. Again, the world was a different place back then. So two funny stories. The way Al found me, again, pre-internet, you know, you couldn't just go on your phone or your computer and listen to radio stations. You actually listened to a radio and turned the dial. CJCL at the time was at 1430. And I guess he was looking, he was told there was a good young host in Albany or Rochester, I'm not sure where, at 1420 on the AM dial. And he's in Connecticut at night when the signals are clear, trying to find this guy in Albany, and accidentally finds me in Toronto. How he hears a Toronto radio station in Connecticut, it blows me away, but one of the many, you know, good breaks that I've gotten. And that's how he found me. And then when they said, we'd like to fly you down to audition for ESPN Radio, I said, great. I didn't realize that audition means you're actually doing the show on the air. And I go down there, and all of a sudden I'm working with ESPN guys, and I'm doing interviews about U.S. college football and things I have no clue about because I just wasn't into that stuff then. And it was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. So, but I wound up doing that on weekends. So for about a year and a half, I worked at the Fan Monday to Friday and was down at ESPN in Bristol, Connecticut, doing weekend radio.
Obviously had a huge role in ESPN baseball for a long time. Now back with the Blue Jays on a limited level, but still there, 50 games on TV, 30 or so on the radio. Out of all the baseball you've done, first, what's your favorite game that you've ever been to? I know you were at Bartman. I don't know if that's a favorite game, but it's definitely a memorable one.
The Bartman game is up there because of the, you know, the Cubs hadn't won at that point, right? So you're still dealing with the curse and all that, and they were up, and it looked like they were going to the World Series, and we'd never seen a play like that impact a game that important in that manner. So that game's on the list. Game 6 of the 2011 World Series, St. Louis, Texas.
Feliz has the sign he wants. Freeze waiting. The 1-2 and a fastball hit to right field. Going back is Cruz, and it is off the wall. It bounces back toward the infield.
Which might not be as well remembered, but it should be, because there have only been 3 times in baseball history where a team was a strike away from winning the World Series and didn't win the World Series. And 2 of the 3 happened in that game. David Freeze, Texas was a strike away from winning when Freeze hit the triple in the 9th. Texas was a strike away from winning when Berkman hit the single in the 10th, and then Freeze homered in the 11th. to win the game. I was exhausted after that game. It was so much fun, though.
3-2, a swing and a high fly ball. Center field. It is gone! David Freeze, who tied it in the ninth, wins it in the 11th. In one of the most remarkable, improbable baseball games you will ever see. And there's going to be baseball here in St. Louis. Game 7 tomorrow night.
I would say I was lucky enough to do the Bautista home run, the bat flip game for ESPN Radio.
The 1-1. Bautista drives it. Deep left field. Gone! The Blue Jays dugout has erupted as they greet Bautista. At the edge of the track, suddenly it is 6-3 for Toronto. Unfortunately, there's more debris on the field, and that needs to stop.
You were in the ballpark that night,
yeah.
And I remember texting you and your brother and your grandparents when they were littering the field with bottles and saying, do not leave your seats after the game. I will come get you. I don't want you guys to go out by yourself. And then Bautista homered, and I texted you and said, it's okay, we're good. I'll meet you at the car. Everything's going to be fine. So I would say those are probably the three that jump out at me. I've also been lucky enough to do two no-hitters, and you were at one of them. A buddy of yours and you just happened to be on this annual baseball road trip that you and I try to do, and Jake Arrieta threw a no-hitter at Dodger Stadium, and you were there. So that was very fun as well.
This might overlap with that question, but your favorite call, I would think, is the Freeze call, but what is your favorite within your body of work, baseball or basketball even?
That's a good question. I tend to think of it as what games I've loved doing more as opposed to what calls I've had. But the David Freeze home run in the 11th to win it is one of my favorites. And I would say the other one is a college basketball game that I did for ESPN. It's Kentucky and Indiana. Kentucky had Anthony Davis. They were number one, undefeated. They were unbeatable, unstoppable. It's a late November, early December game, somewhere around there. And Indiana is not great. Tom Crean's just been there a couple of years, and they're starting to build back towards being Indiana. And Indiana inbounds the ball with about 4 or 5 seconds left. And a guy named Christian Watford hits the shot. And it's one of those where the ball leaves his hand, the horn goes when the ball's in the air, and it's not like they were already tied. It was lose or win. There was no tie. I think they were either down 2 and 1 by 1 or down 1, 1 by 2. I can't remember which it was.
I believe they were down 2.
I think they were down 2 and 1 by 1. So the ball's in the air and the game's going to be decided. And just a fluky little lucky break for me. Everybody loves alliteration. And I don't know why or where or how, but I said Watford for the win. And the ball went in.
2-point lead. No timeouts for Indiana. Jones. Watford for the win!
Yes! Yes! Oh! Unbelievable! Unbelievable! Can't believe it!
I would say that one's probably my favorite out of everything. There's some screaming after that you didn't mention.
Both me and Dickie V got very excited. Dickie V got very excited.
It was
a big shot. Yeah. If I could redo the after part, I would redo it, but the Watford for the win part I was happy with.
Thinking back now, you know, looking at everything, you won an award in 2011, I believe the year was, from the NSSA. What did that kind of recognition mean to you? To get recognized as the broadcaster of the year that, you know, Bob Costas and all so many other esteemed broadcasters have won.
It meant a lot, mostly because it was voted on by my peers. It was voted on by other broadcasters. And you know, to be a Canadian recognized in the U.S. meant a lot to me. And to go down there and, you know, like you said, to look back at previous winners and see Dick Enberg or Al Michaels or Bob Costas or Chris Berman or whoever the case may be, you know, guys that I've admired so much. I remember just when I found out I was a finalist, and there are 10 people on the finalist list, I was blown away. And I remember where we were. I don't know if you remember this because you were younger. We were coming back from a skiing day. We were skiing, and we found out, like, over the Christmas New Year holiday or something like that, I got a phone call that said that I had won. And I just, it was hard for me to believe it because I just don't think, you know, in those terms very often. But It was really fun. It was really cool to go down to North Carolina. Oral Hershiser and Terry Francona were working with me at the time on Sunday Night Baseball, and ESPN was nice enough to buy a table, and they flew Terry in, and they flew Oral in, and some of the executives were there, and people I had worked with were there, and it was really cool. It was really special.
I mentioned this before. We're going to circle back a little back with the Blue Jays. What is different and maybe something that you like now about being local? Again, not that you're completely local, but
right.
But local in terms of baseball, perhaps.
Well, doing a game and sleeping in your own bed is nice. You know, being exclusively with ESPN for so many years, I never had that opportunity. As far as I know, Toronto doesn't have an NCAA basketball team. If they do, they're never on my schedule. So it's just nice to be home a little bit more. And it's doing national and doing local, although the Blue Jays are a national team, but doing, you know, working for ESPN on baseball in a national sense and then covering the Blue Jays are very different, because when you're there on a daily basis with a team, you get an opportunity to form deeper relationships, to know what's going on with the team more. You know, the same people are watching you game after game after game. And I think it's just, there's just a comfort and a familiarity that exists. You know, and also it's fun for me, again, knowing that you're such a big fan, that your big brother Matthew is such a big fan, that your grandparents are such big fans. You know, that's part of the fun for me as well, to share it with you guys. I mean, I've always told people if I really wanted to get some street cred with you and your brother, I'd do hockey. That's where it really lies for you guys. But, you know, just to be able to call you in the car on the way home, or if you're down at the game, if we drive home together and we talk about the game, that's the fun stuff. Listen, I was born here. I've lived here my whole life. So, you know, to have a chance to do games again here has really been enjoyable.
Well, you know, if the Leafs need someone down the stretch,
I think they're in great shape. You know what I would settle for? I would settle for them winning a Stanley Cup in my lifetime. They have won a Stanley Cup in my lifetime, but I was 3 months old, so I would settle for them winning another Stanley Cup in my lifetime. How's that?
Yeah, that would be nice. Well, you know, nothing against the Blue Jays, but the Leafs might be the closest one right now of any team in this city to winning a championship, depending on what your opinion of the Raptors is. But thank you very much for this time. A lot of interesting stuff, a lot of stuff that I didn't know. Thought I came into it with more knowledge than I did, but it was fun. I enjoyed it a lot.
It was fun for me, too. Thank you.
All right.
Good. I need to find a way to stop and let my head cool down. It's racing fast to a ball with all my thoughts running round.
And that'll do it for this week's edition of A Swing and a Bell. Big thanks to the Sheepdogs for providing the music on this week's podcast. You can reach our producer, Emil Delich, on Twitter at AmanDelic. You can find Ben at BenShulman7, and you can find me at DShulman_ESPN. We hope you enjoyed this one, and next week, something fun. A good friend of mine, an old friend of mine, a guy I worked with for a number of years, a real character as a player and as a broadcaster, a member of that famous 1993 Philadelphia Phillies team, John Kruk, will be among our guests on the podcast next week. Until then, happy Father's Day, and thanks for listening.
Joe has had his moments, trying to lay off that ball low to the outside part of the plate, and he just went after one. Two balls and two strikes on it. Here's the pitch on the way, a swing and a belt, left field, way back, Blue Jays win it! The Blue Jays are World Series champions as Joe Turner hits a three-run home run in the ninth inning, and the Blue Jays have repeated as World Series champions. Touch them all, Joe. You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life.